Morning, we're going to call the Government Operations and Election Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative Pugh, could I have a motion on the minutes from March 3rd?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes for March 3rd.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Pugh moves approval of the minutes from March 3rd. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved for March 3rd. Welcome, everyone. We have one bill on the agenda today, and that will take probably most of our time. Just a little ground rules before we get started, just so everyone understands. We will be taking a final vote on this bill before our committee time ends today at noon. And so the testifier list is continuing to grow, and so we'll try and accommodate everyone that we can. But I just encourage everyone, as they're testifying in support or opposition of the bill, that you please be brief and succinct in your comments and do your best to not repeat things that have already been said in the committee from previous testifiers. But we'll try to accommodate everyone that wishes to speak on the House File 1261. With that, I see Representative Kreisha is in the room, and we will bring Representative Kreisha to the table. Okay. And I will go ahead and move House File 1261 to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And before we get into the bill, quickly, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Today I am joined by my lovely daughter, Hannah, who's going to stand up and wave. She wanted to come and see what Dad does every day down here at the Capitol, and Hannah is one of our six children. So, hey, kid.
Awesome. Well, welcome, Hannah. Thanks for being with us today, Representative Kreisha. We've made a motion on your bill to state government finance, and with that, we'll go ahead and welcome you to the committee and let you proceed.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. May I ask how old is your daughter?
Hannah, stand up. Yeah. Tell Representative Kreisha how old you are.
I'm 11.
And Hannah, I know this is going to come to you as probably off the cuff, but would you like to come up here and testify with me and have a, you can have front row seat, and you know what? Come on up if you'd like. Have a seat.
All right, we've successfully scarred an 11-year-old for the rest of her life.
Have fun with me. This will be great. I'll tell you what to say.
Representative Kreisha.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Before I get into my talking points, what I'd like to lay out is, for as long as I've been here, and I have a very long career down here, as you know. I think this is my second term. But everything that I have seen down here from State Gov and Representative Nelson, you and I sat on State Gov last session, we're always responding to our constituents with rules that are being made. We always seem to hear these things that are coming up. And as representatives, we're being told, go down there and fix this. Go down there and change this rule. And so the conversation is out there. The conversation is continually happening. I believe Representative Fabian has a bill out there to address that this year on water quality things. So we're always reacting to the pressures of our communities and the economic strife that goes on with the reality or perception of a rule that comes down that negatively impacts our areas. So this bill is that conversation. This bill is starting that. I know it's been happening before. And so what I would ask as I go through the points, and I know we're going to have lots of back and forth on this, but what I would ask for this committee is, let's make this a conversation. Let's talk about it. And I will, in good faith, whatever notes I get from here, I will try my darndest to get all the groups together and to fix that before our next committee. That's what I would offer up. So I just want you to think about that as I'm trying to do this and what I'm trying to do with the rulemaking. This bill addresses laws governing the rulemaking process, obviously, and the agencies are going to have to determine the statement of need and reasonableness if a proposed rule has a substantial economic impact. If the rule does, it will undergo a review by a panel created by the legislative auditor. And I've heard many times that we are the peer review. I believe in State Gov, as we were relinquishing the Sunset Commission, one of the comments that was made was, we are the ones as legislators that should have the final approval. We are the ones that should have that final authority. That's why we're here. This panel must address the following criteria: by qualifying the impact to a private sector economy in an amount of $5 million or more in a single year, If the new rule increases the cost or prices to businesses or local governments, has an adverse effect or an adverse impact to Minnesota businesses, or the cost of compliance in the first year of the rule is $25,000 for any one business with less than 50 employees, or affects a local government with less than 10 employees. The report by the legislative auditor will be delivered to the chairs of committees with jurisdiction of the proposed rule and will not take effect until it is approved by legislature. And I have a whole bunch of notes here, but I'll just make this simple. When a rule comes out, I believe that we should have the ability to look at that as an economic impact, bring it into a committee that can look at that in peer review, and decide if it makes good sense before we go forward and hopefully take action. With that, I know we have a whole bunch of testifiers, Mr. Chair, and I certainly don't want to stand in the way of their good testimony.
Thank you, Representative Kresha. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kresha. I never remember how to say your name right. I'm sorry.
I keep changing it on you, Representative.
Well, that's good. That's because that confuses me. It keeps me confused. That's good. I know this is similar to a bill that I worked on last session that we tried to, and my bill might have started more to this side, and we worked all session long to get it towards the center. I think this one goes a little bit too far this direction, and I hope you're up at your word that you want to work with and get this down, because there's a lot involved in the rulemaking and getting to a sweet spot, or as Representative Davids talks about, peace in the valley between the agencies and the other constituents out there in the state, be it the individuals, be it private businesses, be it the cities, the townships. So I hope as you work through this that we're not going to ramrod something through to change something. I think if we're going to do this, I think we need to get to the sweet spot in the middle where we do get peace in the valley, or as close to it as we can. Right now, I don't know if we're at that point from what I'm hearing from different constituency groups that approached me. So with that, I think that's my point.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Kresha, any follow-up?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, that's why I made my opening comments. We do not have the perfect solution. There's no question. And you've worked on this. You know, and in fact, yesterday as I was talking to a couple of folks, I specifically said, where is Representative Nelson at? Let's get him as part of this conversation, because the only way we're really going to move forward is if we get to that sweet spot. And it's not going to be easy, here, as you know. So I am more than willing to put a good policy in place and to get to that process. That's what my hope is. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Representative Kresha. With that, we will begin with testimony. Where's the agenda? Who's first on the agenda? Sorry, just looking for my list. Here we go. First on the agenda that I have is Gretchen Sable. Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chair, my name is Gretchen Sable, and I'm a volunteer lobbyist for League of Women Voters. As you know, League is a good government organization, and it's our mission to encourage informed and active participation in government. That's what our sole purpose is, to make sure that people have the tools they need to participate effectively in government. Are we good on audio?
Yes, okay. We can hear you just fine. Thank you.
The League does not support or oppose any candidate or political party. The League also develops advocacy positions through a grassroots process from our membership. I'm here specifically representing two positions of League today. The first is that the League of Women Voters Minnesota promotes an open governmental system that's representative, accountable, and responsive, and that League works to protect the citizens' right to know and seeks to facilitate citizen participation in government-making decision-making. So what we're about is making sure that people have the tools to participate effectively and the opportunities to participate effectively. League of Women Voters supports the right of all citizens to know what their government's doing and to participate in government decisions at all levels. Transparency and citizen participation are top priorities. My remarks today will focus on the public process that gives opportunity for citizen participation in rulemaking. the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. Executive branch rulemaking follows a process that utilizes our constitutional balance of power and engages all three branches of government as well as Minnesota's citizens. The legislature gives agencies the authority to undertake rulemaking and mandates the rulemaking process to follow in the Administrative Procedure Act, or the APA. The APA's required process opens the rulemaking for public input and requires oversight by an administrative law judge. I'd also like to say, in response to Representative Crenshaw's openings, that agencies also notify the legislature at various points in the process, and so there is a back and forth with the legislative branch as well. And as Representative Crescia said, there's also callbacks where the legislature calls agencies back, and so there's a control that's exerted that way as well. The process laid out in the APA is orderly and provides opportunities for both the public and the regulated communities to comment on the facts and policies that underlie the proposed rules. Public comments are solicited at several points in the process, and these comments are meticulously documented and addressed. It's the role of the judge to ensure that the process is carefully followed. And again, you know, I'm a retired person now, but when I did work in state agencies, I've done a number of rulemakings, and we see that the judge is very active in overseeing and making sure that the processes are followed. And so with that, you see the triangle with the legislative branch giving orders, the executive following the orders, and the judicial overseeing. This bill, House File 1261, adds steps to the rulemaking process and could allow additional legislative oversight to take precedence over the orderly public process in law today. A further concern with this bill is that the standards and the definition of substantial economic impact are vague, referring to significant cost and significant impact. What's significant to one may be of less concern to others. How would the public know what triggers this additional review? The state's Administrative Procedures Act requires solicitation of public input and allows ample opportunity for peer review and alternative policy, economic, and scientific analysis. The League of Women Voters of Minnesota's concerns are that this bill will increase the influence of politics and special interests over citizen interest. The League of Women Voters of Minnesota believes that the public has a right to take part in agency rulemaking through an orderly public process. We hope that you will keep citizens in mind as you review House File 1261 and any other bills that would pull rank over the orderly public process laid out in statute today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Sable. Thank you. Next on the list we have Mr. Tony Quillis. Welcome, gentlemen. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I want to thank you for the time to comment today on Representative Crenshaw's, that's probably the third pronunciation of it this morning, House File 1261. The Chamber is in support of House File 1261. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the reason the Chamber cares about it is we'll come up and debate issues before the legislature, but then also after the legislature adjourns, the state agencies, either through direction of the legislature or by themselves through federal rules, take up rulemaking process. And there is public input, as Ms. Sable mentioned, as we go through the process, but the impact on the business community in general, and I'll give you one example here in a little bit, it can be tremendous at times. Sometimes if the impact is small, this bill wouldn't trigger it. But there are times where the cumulative effect of the rules go through and have a significant impact on the business community. I'll give you one example. There is some water quality rules that are moving through the Pollution Control Agency right now that would go through and have a statewide impact to go through. And it would, as Representative Fenton has heard, it would impact our agricultural area, agricultural processors, our industrial members, as well as municipalities. And that has a direct and indirect impact on us, whether we have water quality permits known as NPDES permits, and whether that directly infects us, or if we discharge into a municipal system where they have an NPDES permit and are required to meet those standards, that has an indirect impact on the business community. But that cumulative impact of whether it be the water quality issues of water for sulfate or for nitrates or for phosphorus, that cumulative impact has a big impact on economic development projects in the state of Minnesota. And speaking of that sulfate standard, if you remember, there is a debate going on right now over the sulfate standard in the state of Minnesota. And we went through a peer review process and are going through that right now with the PCA. So there is some precedent set and going through and doing the peer review that Representative Kreshov points out in his bill. As Representative Nelson has referenced, this is an issue that's been around for a while, and we worked very closely with him last year in trying to work with the Dayton administration to find some happy medium, if you will. But this rules debate has been around for a while. Some of us have been around. There was, used to be called the Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules that allowed the legislature to have, if you will, a second set of eyes or to double-check the state agencies. So, and it's not just the Pollution Control Agency, which is the example I use. There's the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, maybe even the Board of the Department of Education might have rules that will trigger some of these impacts and would just allow either the Legislative Coordinating Commission or through Office of Legislative Auditor to set up a peer review panel to go through and just let the legislature, if you will, double check the homework of the state agencies. So with that, Mr. Chairman or Madam Chair, I thank you for the time to speak in support of House File 1261, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Johnson and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. And Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. We are happy to be here working with Representative Kreshov, and we do support House File 1261. The League of Minnesota Cities has for a long time had policies that make it very clear that the costs of regulatory issues need to be adequately known, and we need to know them in time to plan for our communities, especially if they're going to be expensive. And in particular, since the only way many of our communities can afford to look at these improvements is if there is adequate funding available to meet those requirements coming through state programs that finance public infrastructure. So we feel it's very important, the provisions of this bill, that will make sure, one, that those costs are checked, peer-reviewed, to make sure that the costs were adequately calculated, that there were not omissions made or estimates made that aren't factually defendable. And then, secondly, that that information does get transmitted to the legislature in a timely fashion so that that information is in front of the people who do appropriations to deal with those needs. I would clarify that the sections of this bill that deal with legislative approval of rules is not an issue that the League has a position on. We neither support or oppose legislative approval of rules, so that, that section I don't have a position I would take on. But in reference to comments that preceded the bill being presented, we went through extensive discussions last session. I think extensive is even a light word to use if Representative Nelson remembers those as vividly as I do, with the administration on changes to the administrative rules proceedings, extensive changes, significant changes. And I actually am very comfortable saying that as this moves forward, I think those are an important part of the discussion, to look at if we're going to be looking at administrative rule writing proceedings, let's look at them and continue to meet with all of the interests. I know from our perspective at the League, we are very much interested in working with the administration on addressing concerns they might have with this. We obviously will work with members of the legislature on this throughout the session as this bill is discussed, and would very much be interested in looking at provisions from last year's discussion of administrative rules that would be appropriate to be part of this, because this really is where the effect of law hits local government. When the rules are adopted that implement the statutes that you do is where we have the financial impacts. And so it's a very significant issue, and very appreciative that you are taking the time to look at this issue this year. Thank you. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And Mr. Quillis, if there aren't any questions, we'll move on to our next testifier. Thank you. So our next testifier is Niall Zickmund. Is Niall here?
Madam Chair, I think you have Bob Piska on the agenda, if we can testify together.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And please announce your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Niles Zickman, Chief at Spring Lake Park, Blaine Mousenbeat, here today representing the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, and my colleague is the chair of our code committee, and so I'll be speaking to the broad policy issue, and he'll be speaking more to the technical side. We're not here to speak in support or in opposition to the bill, just to share our concerns. We're passionate about a small number of things. The fire code and the development of the fire code is one of them. Year after year after year, the Minnesota Taxpayers Association does a How Does Minnesota Compare report, and we rank 21st in the nation. Population-wise, that hasn't changed, and we continually rank 45th, 46th, 47th, the most recent report, 47th in the nation in per capita fire expense. That's an extraordinary number. All of your other public services rank anywhere from 4th to 20th, yet the fire service, time after time, ranks 47th. There's a very good reason for that. It's a small number of reasons. One of them is the fire code. We have a large disproportionate share of firefighters in this state that are volunteer. 18,000 to 20,000. It is saving literally taxpayers in the state hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And one of the reasons is because we have a very strong fire code and a fire marshal's office that supports that. And so we get passionate about that fire code because it, from a chief's level, if my fire problem is a working house fire, that's a lot different than if my fire problem is apartments burning, commercial industrial buildings burning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why we're passionate about the code making process. In general, and then I'll have Chair Fisk talk about the rulemaking process, our biggest concern is adding any more time to the process. And anything we can do, I think Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except all the rest, and I think rulemaking is part of that, okay? So anything we can do to help streamline it, we'll be committed to working with Representative Kreisha to help that. So with that, Madam Chair, if I may, have Chief Fisk talk about the fire code specifically and what's been involved in that.
Thank you, Mr. Zickman. And Mr. Fisk, if you could please announce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Robert Fisk. I am the chairperson for the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Code Committee. As that chair, I work with a committee of folks that are made up of representatives of the State Fire Marshal's Office, the Department of Industry and Labor. We have other fire chiefs, fire marshals. We have industry specialists, fire protection engineers, architects, and so forth that sit on that committee. Our main task is to work with the state agencies to try and develop our state fire code. That state fire code process does go through the rulemaking process. It starts with a nationally based fire code. In our case here in the state of Minnesota, we use what's called the International Fire Code. We start with that national code, and then we make adjustments, amendments, and rule changes to that code to fit our particular needs here in the state of Minnesota. Our committee is represented from folks throughout the state. It's not just a metro local area. That process has gotten longer and longer, and our concern with this particular bill is that it potentially could add additional time to that. We are currently working on trying to adopt the 2012 edition of the International Fire Code with our changes, with the amendments, and we're already in 2015. So we're 3 years behind the process. We're currently using a state fire code that was adopted in 2007. So we're 8 years behind on that particular code. And one of the problems with that time delay and the amount of time it takes to do this is technology is way ahead of us. So, and we're not staying current with what is available out there. And we hear from industry leaders in the different fields that are regulated by fire codes that, why are we not using the most up-to-date and standard codes and standards that are out there? And part of it is the amount of time it takes to go through the process. So, again, as Chief Zickman mentioned, our concern with this is the amount of time that this could potentially add to that rulemaking process. Again, we work through that process and are willing to work through that process, but we're concerned that it could potentially delay things even longer than what we have right now. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. We really appreciate it. And thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. And then we'll make the commitment to work with Representative Kreisha. Anything we can do to improve the timeline would be beneficial to us, too.
Can I get a ride in the big red truck?
You can drive the big red truck. Bring Hannah along. We have a tiller. She can be the tiller woman.
Great. Thank you very much. And our next testifier is Mr. Strand, Scott Strand. I like riding the truck too. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strand. Would you please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Strand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCA. I am also, this year, the Chairman of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which is an umbrella organization of the some 70-odd environmental groups in Minnesota. I also will just say that as part of my background as been a government lawyer, I spent the first half of my legal career in the State Attorney General's office and have been around almost every aspect of rulemaking for much of the last 30 years. We oppose this legislation, and I want to outline some of the reasons why. Let me start by making just a couple of observations. First of all, there are good reasons why the legislature delegates rulemaking authority to the agencies. No agency can do rulemaking without authorization from the legislature. The reason the legislature authorizes rulemaking is because there are some issues that involve highly technical, complex, scientific issues that require a lot of work and a lot of substantive expertise, and a lot of time. Time that the legislature doesn't have, expertise that the legislature doesn't have, and that's why we delegate that function to agencies, so that they can apply the science and the facts to the situation within the context of a delegation of authority and make judgments about the best way to go. If we lose the rulemaking process, we lose the ability to do that. And don't be confused. This is not a peer review bill, with all due respect. This is a bill that would largely stop the rulemaking process in its tracks. It'll certainly slow down any rules that are already in the hopper. But once there's a law on the books that requires legislative approval of rules, I mean, most agencies aren't going to use the rulemaking process anymore. They'll simply bring their proposals to the legislature and try to get bills passed. We won't see sonars. We won't see comment periods. We won't see the regulatory checks and opportunities for public participation that the rulemaking process gives us, because there won't be any reason for the agencies to do that. If they need legislative approval in the first place, they're just going to come here directly. And so we lose all of those opportunities to do that. The other part of this, of course, is that this would give the power to stop a rule in something less than a majority of the legislature. All of us have seen the cartoon about how a bill becomes law, but everybody in this room knows that there are a million ways that a bill does not become law. Bills that can get hung up in committees, they can get hung up on leadership desks, they can be subject to vetoes. Something far less than a majority of the legislature can stop a proposal from going through. That means that I think a lot of regulations are going to stop under this kind of a proposal, because a small, dedicated minority will be able to stop them. If we do that, we lose the benefits of regulation. We talk a lot about the costs of regulation. We can argue about, you know, whether those costs have been overstated. But the benefits are real. The benefits of regulations in Minnesota have a lot to do with public health, with safety. The fire folks were just here. They deal with the integrity of business relationships. Obviously, we have rules that deal with interpretation of the tax code. We have a whole range of rules, all of which have often very significant benefits. I'll bring one example up. It's a federal rule, but I think it's illustrative of what I'm trying to get across. There's one rule at the federal level which is almost universally acknowledged as being the most expensive rule for our businesses and everyone else to comply with. It's a Clean Air Act rule. It has to do with what are called fine particulates, PM2.5, basically soot. And it's been estimated that it's cost American businesses several billion dollars to comply with that fine particulate standard. The OMB, Office of Management and Budget, at the federal level, has for the past 10, 15 years been doing an analysis of costs and benefits of regulations, And they estimate, and have in both Republican and Democratic administrations, that that fine particulate standard, every dollar spent on it returns $30 of benefit to the economy in terms of reduced lost work days, in terms of reduced health care expenses, in terms of all things that ultimately come to the bottom line of businesses. So we stop regulations in their tracks with a procedure like this, we lose the benefits of those regulations. There are costs, to be sure, but if we lose the benefit side of it, we're really doing, I think, the citizens of Minnesota a disservice. Two other observations about the process. One, legislature already has lots of ways to influence the outcome of a rulemaking process. Obviously, it's not just at the end. It starts with the delegation of authority to the agencies in the first place. The legislature can make those delegations as broad or as narrow or as specific as it wants to, so that opportunity is there. Legislature can also, after rules are adopted, pass a law with both houses and the governor's signature that changes that rule. Can repeal it, it can modify it, that can happen. That's all available to the legislature. And as I think the testimony before indicated, the Administrative Procedures Act itself has all sorts of different ways that the legislature can get involved in the process. Practically speaking, legislators are in touch with agencies every day. There are no rulemaking processes that are going through the system where there isn't several places where legislators or committees have some input into the process. So the notion that the legislature doesn't have any influence on the process, I think, is just wrong. We have a very real problem, which is that often, and the fire chiefs referred to this, is that delay can cause some serious problems. It's not just that we lose the benefits of the regulation, but especially in the environmental area, a lot of the rulemaking that we do is pursuant to a federal mandate. For example, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is obligated by federal law to update the clean water standards every 3 years. We delay that process, we fall out of compliance with the federal law, which means that the delegation of authority from the federal agency, the EPA, to the state is in jeopardy, and we really risk the idea that we're going to end up being held in out of compliance with federal law, which means that the EPA comes in and takes over a large part of the operation. That's not a positive outcome, really, for anybody. And I submit, and we'll take a look at some of the other areas, that there are other agencies where that federal mandate is what's driving the rulemaking. And there is almost always a time element that's involved in that, and so we put our agencies at risk of being out of compliance with federal law, which is only a deadweight cost. That's litigation over that. Dealing with the federal agencies doesn't add to the value of any of these rules at all.
Mr. Sharon, if you would move to your closing comments, please.
I'll make one more comment, and it's a good one, Mr. Chair. I think this legislation is unconstitutional. Back in 1983, the United States Supreme Court reviewed, in a case called Immigration and Naturalization Service versus CHATA, a provision that gave the Congress veto authority over certain actions taken by the INS, and the court struck it down as a violation of a number of provisions in the U.S. Constitution. Since that time, legislative veto provisions at the state level have been struck down by several state Supreme Courts. We don't have a ruling, I don't think, in Minnesota, and there's more research to be done, but I think there's a very strong likelihood that anything that requires legislative approval of rules is going to be raise some serious constitutional problems, because rulemaking has been accepted as an inherent part of the function of the executive, not a function of the legislature. So there's serious constitutional issues, which I think the committee needs to review before it takes this process any further. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strand, as you heard earlier, I was working on this last year, mm-hmm. and what is the difference between our state rulemaking process and the federal rulemaking process? And the reason I'm asking this goes back to your comment about if our Minnesota EPA or Pollution Control Agency falls out of compliance, that the federal government would take that function over. So how differently do they do those two function, though, the way we write rules here and the way the federal government writes rules?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, a couple of differences. Our state rulemaking process has a lot of requirements that wouldn't apply to federal rulemaking. A lot of federal rulemaking is done through a notice and comment process, although over the years a lot of additional requirements for cost-benefit analyses and impact on small business and impact on state and local government have been added to the process. More importantly, though, in the environmental context, and this is true in other contexts like OSHA and some other state programs, these are programs where we operate at the state level pursuant to a delegation of authority from the feds. So the federal agency will say, well, you can do it, you can enforce the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, but you're going to be subject to federal standards and you're going to be subject to federal evaluation. And if you don't adopt standards that are required by federal law, or if you fail to enforce standards that have been approved by the federal agency, you run afoul of those federal requirements. Now, there's all sorts of things that can come from that. At the end of the process is what's called de-delegation, where the agency will actually pull it back and the EPA will run the program and folks would have to run to Chicago to get their permits. Lots of steps before we get there, where corrective action notices will come from the EPA. Deadlines will be imposed by which they need to come into compliance with those standards. And so it's instead of working to, for example, clean up the water, clean up the air, our agency ends up working to deal with the EPA. And that's something that I think we have to keep in mind. If we adopt some provision into state law, that's going to have the effect of either delaying or killing the rulemaking process.
Representative Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the other thing that I learned and he didn't touch on was where our rulemaking process in the state, we have the notice process and go through it, and at the end, the rules go into effect. At the federal level, they can put the rules into effect, and then they go through a lot of lawsuits and court cases, and they can do them without some of the safeguards we have in to protect our businesses, our counties, our cities, that and make it take it longer for us to get new rules. The federal government has more power to put the rules into effect right now without a lot of comment period from people. So, I mean, that's another thing we need to be careful of, is if we stop it at the state level, that and in this case, the federal EPA takes over and starts implementing rules, that some of our comment period is going to go away and we're going to be stuck with the rules that and we won't have any say over them.
Representative Crucia.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to jump in real quick because I want to take this conversation to a comment that I heard, in all due respect to Mr. Strand, but he mentioned the word constitutional, and I had to think about this for a second. I knocked on doors. I asked people what they wanted, and I'm representing 39,000 people in my area to get down here. I never said to those 39,000 people, I'm going to go down and delegate your rights away, or I'm going to go down and delegate what you're asking me away. And what I heard here was an agency sitting next to me saying, you gave us the authority, and now I'm going to say to you that it's unconstitutional for you to take that authority back. I just want us to think about how we got here and why we're here. If I'm just a passive bystander, if I can go back to my district with plausible deniability to say, hands off, I really didn't do this and the agency did it and we have no way, I don't think that that's the role that I'm comfortable playing. And so I just wanted to offer that up in response to what I heard.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, Mr. Strand, so what you're saying is you think that this rulemaking should be left in the hands of the agencies that oversee the area.
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, that's basically right. I mean, that the process as it currently stands, I mean, let me just clarify, I'm not with an agency. I'm not representing a government agency. We're advocates before the agency, so if there is some confusion about that, I wanted to clear that up. And second, I don't want to suggest that there isn't room for some rulemaking reform. I tend to agree with the fire chiefs who are here that there's we have a lot of things that have been added to the APA over the years that don't necessarily add a lot of value to the process, but they do slow it down. They do make it more expensive, and I think we should take a good hard look at those. But ultimately, once the legislature, the way the legislature should control the rulemaking process is through its delegation of authority. once it's decided that there are a set of issues where decisions need to be made by the agencies, usually because of their complexity, the science, the facts, the analysis that are involved, then making sure that those delegations are that accurately reflect what the legislature's intent is the best way to do it. Once you have a legislative veto or a requirement for legislative approval at the back end, you short-circuit that whole rulemaking process. And so the courts have had, you know, serious constitutional concerns with legislative veto provisions or legislative approval requirements for rules all over the country. I think I owed it to the committee to let you know that that law is out there and is something that is going to have to be addressed if this moves forward. But, yeah, basically, once the legislature has delegated and made it clear what it intends, let the agencies do their job. And when there are federal deadlines, let them do their job quickly.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So, you know, there's a lot of science out there. Science keeps getting more and more advanced to where I think at one point for air and water quality we were at parts per million. Now it's moved up to parts per billion. I'm not even sure if it's not parts per trillion right now. So what if agencies started saying, yeah, we think that's really a stringent guideline, and we go back to parts per million or even parts per thousands for pollutants in air and water. Would you still think that the agencies came up with these rules, would you still think that the agencies were the ones that were best suited to make those decisions, make those rules?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, I think the agency should make those decisions, and there are cases in the environmental area where standards do get relaxed because the science points in that direction. In the most famous examples of that, I think, are in the food safety area, where chemicals that have been added to food have been banned, and then it's turned out later that the scientific case for them being banned wasn't very strong. So it can go that way, too. It doesn't always get stricter. The one thing I will say that I'll add in the context of environmental standards is that because of the federal overlay, the state doesn't have the unilateral authority to just make the changes without any kind of review. There is a federal process for reviewing it, and the EPA will require that any change in our water or air standards have a scientific basis behind it. So it's a little bit different than in a case where the state has all of the jurisdiction. But otherwise, the state should make those decisions. If they think the standards should be relaxed, they should build the scientific case for that, if there is a scientific case for it, and then make that presentation to the EPA.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question regarding costs to the state of relaxing these standards. I know a lot of programs that our state runs leverages federal dollars in many, many ways. And could a delay in rulemaking or becoming out of compliance with rulemaking put those federal dollars that many of our programs, I think about Health and Human Services because I serve on the Finance Committee and Medical Assistance and WIC and SNAP and some of those programs that are really important to our state, could we lose federal dollars over this as well?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, yes.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's helpful to hear. I think that we need to look at all costs when we think about public policy and in costs that we might not be thinking about how it might impact our taxpayers, and that could be a big one. I have a second question, Mr. Chair. Question I would have would be regarding the constitutionality issue that you brought up, which I think is an interesting one. You cited some case law, and so I just wanted to get a sense from you about your background and your understanding of case law. It sounds like you worked for the Attorney General's office, and so how does that – we're all here to represent our constituents in the best way we can. How does that – your background in case law help us understand how our responsibility to our citizens work.
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, during my time at the Attorney General's office, a big part of my job, most of my job was defending statutes against constitutional attacks. That was part of my responsibility. And part of my additional responsibility was sometimes to help work with the legislature if the legislature is heading towards something that was going to invite a constitutional attack to try to make adjustments so that that wouldn't occur. Again, if we're fighting in court over constitutionality and then fighting about attorney's fees, we're not doing the work of the state. We're just, those are dead weight losses. And so trying to avoid those constitutional problems, I think, is something that is important for legislative committees to consider. Legislative vetoes for the last 30 years have been problematic. And so that's just something that I think we do have to acknowledge. I don't think we have a definitive Minnesota Supreme Court ruling on this topic, but we do have decisions, again, from the U.S. Supreme Court and from other states dealing with similar issues. And a lot of those have gone badly. They're about separation of powers. It's about defining what is the legislative role, what is the executive role. Part of the theory is that if you basically by acting to stop a rule in place, which can be done by a single house of the legislature under this proposal or even a single committee, that's something that needs to be an act of the entire legislature. And so since the legislature can always change the laws that affect the rules afterwards, if it has both houses supporting it and the governor's signature, but giving it to something less than that, giving the authority to change those rules to a single house or to a single committee is where the constitutional problem starts to arise.
Mr. Strand, to that point, can you show me in the bill where that is?
Mr.
According
Chair,
to the comments you just made.
It's the requirement for legislative approval. That's what raises the constitutional issue.
Well, you just said it could be vetoed by either house, and so I'm curious as to where that is in the bill.
So a bill, a rule goes through the process, and the agency brings it over to the legislature. If it doesn't get the support of either house, one house can say we don't support it, and it's gone. Because the legislature wouldn't have approved it.
But going through that process, this bill would become the way that rulemaking would be done. It would require both houses and the governor's signature. So that would be the new delegation of authority.
It would
from the legislature to the executive branch.
Mr. Chair, as I understand the bill, the approval of a rule would require both legislative houses and the governor. But obviously anything short of that counts as disapproval, which is also an act of the legislature. And that's where we run into the constitutional issues.
But again, though, that would be this bill, if this was actually signed into law, all rulemaking going forward would have to operate under this authority. This is the legislature's prerogative in saying that, agency, you have the ability to rulemake under this authority. And so I fail to see your constitutionality assessment under that if this was signed into law, went through both houses, and was signed by the governor.
Mr. Chair, just to try to clarify, I mean, what the constitutional cases I'm talking about have always been situations where a legislative body, whether it be Congress or a state legislature, has written into law that there will be some kind of executive branch action like rulemaking, and then it'll come back to the legislature for some kind of approval. That's what has caused the problem. It has, obviously, the legislature can make the decision to try to do that, but a court can intervene and say that's a breach of the separation of powers. And courts have, in fact, done that. So that's what I'm trying to address, is that it's the decision by the legislature to have executive actions come back for legislative approval that raises the issue with the courts.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strand, when we sit in committee and as we stand on the floor of the House and we enjoin in a conversation about legislation, and if it's enacted and signed by the governor, in most circumstances that legislative authority authorizes an agency to promulgate rules that are pertinent to that piece of legislation. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that happens often, right?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strand, then, so to the extent that the agency itself determines of its own volition what is best for the best interest of the legislation, aren't we as a body acceding to the negative consent for the agency itself if we don't act prior to that?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I understand the question. Obviously, in those situations where the legislature has decided, typically because of the complexity of the issues, to delegate rulemaking authority to an agency, the next year the agency could be in the middle of that legislative process or that rulemaking process, and the legislature could adopt another statute that changes that delegation of authority or directs the agency to go in a completely different direction. That's also true when rules are finally adopted by an agency pursuant to a statutory delegation. Again, the legislature as a body with the signature of the governor can adopt another law that will change the outcome of that rulemaking process. Where we run into the issues is when we subject that executive branch responsibility to requiring legislative approval after the fact. That's where we run into the legal problems.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strand, I think that's the point I'm trying to make here, is that it's after the fact. It's after the fact that we are having to take action in a sense to overcome a negative consent because we have acquiesced to the agency in promulgating rules that may be contrary to the intent of the legislation itself, and from a body that is acting in the interest of the state, an agency typically is acting in the best interests of the agency itself. And so from a standpoint, my final question is, and this is not meant to be rhetorical, but who ultimately then does the fiduciary responsibility for acts of an agency lie?
Before we answer, if you're sitting by a microphone, can you make sure your phone is off or your tablet? We're getting a bad feedback buzz in the audio system here. Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative, once the executive branch has taken action, it's accountable, obviously, to the legislature, because the legislature can pass another law. But it's also accountable to the courts. If an agency adopts a rule that is contrary to the delegation of authority from the legislature, that is a basis for a court overturning the rule. Representative Nelson, I think, referred to that in the context of federal rulemaking. One place where federal rulemaking and state rulemaking are the same is if an agency adopts a rule that is contrary to the intent of the legislature and its delegation of authority, that's a basis for a court overturning it. And you have access to the courts under the federal rules, access to the courts under the state rules.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in the context that I appreciate your comment, really wasn't the answer that I was driving for, but it really goes to the point that it is after the fact, and the agency is accountable to the legislature. Mm-hmm. And the legislature is responsible for making sure that every agency is responsive to the needs of the state, not to the agency that is promulgating the rules. And to your latter comment, it actually goes to a point of state sovereignty in terms of we do not have to accept federal mandates. Whether there is an incumbency or an encumbrance for funding or not, to Representative Halverson's perspective, that is the prerogative of the state, the legislature, and the executive branch to determine what is in the best interest of acceptance or denial of those funds, not the agency.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one quick question for Mr. Strand, and then the rest of my comments will be to the author of this bill. Mr. Strand, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm not positive. Wondering if Congress has oversight over the federal agencies such as the EPA in the example that you brought.
Madam Chair, Representative,
for rulemaking. Thank you.
Yes, Congress does. And that's, in terms of the issue about, legislative vetoes, that was the case I talked about was in the context of a congressional act. Was at the federal level. But sure, yeah, the EPA can only act pursuant to federal law, which means an act of Congress.
Representative Pugh.
So in follow-up, and thank you, Mr. Strand, just to clarify, does Congress have, it's not legislative, but congressional oversight over rules that federal agencies have promulgated?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, they do in much the same way that the state legislature does here. They have obviously there is congressional oversight of federal agencies. There is state legislative oversight of state agencies. There are revisions all the time to the authority that Congress gives to the agencies. There are changes that are made in the level of budgetary support that agencies get at both the federal and state level. I guess my point is that while I think Congress has all the tools it needs to hold the agencies in line, I think the state legislature already does in this case as well.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the rest of my comments will be directed to the author. And I first want to thank you, Representative Crescia, for bringing this bill, but for starting the conversation. And I believe that was one of the first opening remarks that you made about this rulemaking piece, this very important rulemaking piece. Just this is the start of a very, very important conversation. And as you know, I share your vast experience here in the legislature, just entering my second term. This past session, two sessions, I learned a whole lot, as I'm sure you did, about the legislative process. And one area that I feel I learned more than any other was with regard to rulemaking. And it became crystal clear to me, in fact, I was very surprised, and maybe shocked would be a more appropriate term, that over 100 state agencies have rulemaking authority. And what I didn't understand before I became a member of the legislature, but I'm really crystal clear about now, is that the rules that are promulgated by the agencies have the full force and effect of law. And so this is a very important conversation, and to echo the comments that were so well made by my colleagues, Representative Albright and you as well, Representative Crescia, you know, this is really important. It was surprising to me to take a look just recently as I was preparing an amendment that I brought forward today for this bill, which I'm not going to be moving today. But to take a look at the number of statutes, just, you know, we can see the books and it's volumes of statutes. Well, there's that equal number of volumes of rules. And I think most Minnesotans, I know that as I've been having conversations with my constituents about rules, and that rules have the full force and effect of law, it is very, very shocking to them, and I think it would be a real concern if we didn't move forward with some sort of increased legislative oversight. To your point, it's really incumbent upon us. It's what our constituencies, all of our constituencies, expect of us, to be representing them. And if in fact rules have the full force and effect of law, it's, in my opinion, just very important. You mentioned early on in your opening remarks about this sweet spot, you know, that we need to find. And I would encourage us as a committee that has direct responsibility for rulemaking authority to take a look at that sweet spot being the voice of the people. The people that we represent. Yes, we have, through rulemaking, whether it's expedited or not, we have delegated this responsibility to the agencies, but it's really important that our constituencies have access to government. To the testifier who spoke, Ms. Sable from the League of Women Voters, whose mission, she stated, was ensuring that the government has that the League of Women Voters is promoting open and accessible government. Well, I agree that we should be making government as accessible to the people as possible. And a number of the rules with regard to rulemaking really preclude that, in my opinion. So I'll look forward to continuing this discussion. I mean, I know this is just the beginning, but... You know, I will just comment. I think I don't even have a question other than to say that I think rulemaking is very, very important, and that legislative oversight is even more important to ensure that the rules that have been promulgated are in fact reflective of the will of the people in our districts.
Okay, we have two more member questions, and then I have two additions to the testifier list that we'll move on to. Representative Seltzer and then Representative Lane. Representative Seltzer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is, and thank you, Representative Krishna, for bringing this forward. And, you know, and many, many good things were have been said here, and I appreciate Representative Pugh's comments. You know, and so I've been looking at this and, you know, doing a little research, and we do, the legislature does trump rules. We can, if there's a rule, if there's overreach, we can change that. There is, and when we talk about public input, which I think is very important, as Representative Pugh mentioned, there is public input before these rules are made, and that's documented. However, you know, if there's overreach, we could, you know, change the rule. We could ask the legislative auditor to review it, and then the courts. We can also, you know, there's always that option. So as I was looking at that, we have that system in place, and then looking at your bill, and you would only, you know, we would only be dealing with rules that had a substantial economic impact criteria. I'm trying to envision, you know, what the extent of this, it's a new layer of government, would be. And so I believe there were 62 rules adopted in 2014, and I'm wondering, Representative Krishna, if you know how many would have met the substantial economic impact criteria.
Representative Krishna.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just get clarification, when you say a new layer of government, I'm not sure I understand. What do you mean by new layer of government when we're just doing what we're supposed to be doing?
Right. We.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that question, Representative Krishna. But we would now be reviewing rules. And so right now what we do is we legislate, and we're a part-time legislature. So then we would, whenever there was a substantial economic impact, we would have to become involved. So we would probably have to be here longer because, as you know, we race around to finish in the months that we have. So we would become more of a full-time legislature. But I don't want to jump the gun. So I'm wondering, of the 62 rules that were adopted in 2014, I'm sure you were, you know, looking back at the history, how many met that substantial economic impact criteria? Because I am trying to envision how much longer we would be here, and it would be, you know, we'd have to get experts to come in and advise us, and it's, so it would be a new layer of government, I think.
Representative Krishan, if you need to phone a friend, Mr. Shepard may be able to assist as well.
I'll do two things, and thank you for that. So two things, respectfully, I'll disagree. I mean, we make bills, that's what we do, and I think if you just say we're doing it differently and that's a different layer of government, I'm not sure we're seeing eye to eye on that. And that's okay. I appreciate the conversation on that. As far as the numbers, and we've been trying to hone in on why the 5 million number is right, or why the 25,000, and it's to try to get to a place where we can manage this, because some things will be very simple. And Mr. Shepard, if you have some numbers that could help me on that, that'd be great. Otherwise, we'll punt together, and I'll deal with it between now and the next committee. And I wish I had more concrete, but we're trying to get down there, and we see rules go up and down. I will offer this, and to Cindy, Representative Pugh, and Representative Nelson. This is a conversation that's been going on for a long time, and we're all, you know, there is no we versus they. There's just us, because we're just trying to figure this out, if that helps. And I know I'm being dodgy, and I'll be admitted on that.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, you and I share, and with Representative Pugh, the same extensive legislative experience, being in my second term also. I'm wondering, though, if you could just identify one rule that you believe meets that criteria that you think we should address.
Certainly.
Representative Krishan.
And when we look at a couple of things, whether it's water quality standards, or we look at the fire sprinkler, or we look at energy codes, and I'll look on a broad basis, but there's many times when, and I'll go back to Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian has a bill directly dealing with an impact of what it is to his district, and now he's down making legislation changes. Those specific examples could have been handled in a rulemaking review process, I believe. And the bigger question that I would offer us is, what is our role? Our role is to look at these, and if our role is to delegate away, I'm not comfortable with that.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kresha. And I appreciate your comments. I appreciate the spirit that you brought this here, brought this concern forward, and giving me an example. But it looks like we have a system where Representative Fabian is dealing with this overreach, and we're doing it within the confines of our current system. So maybe at this point in time, you know, I need more conversation. But right now, I need more convincing that our current system can handle these particular cases where there might be some issues.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to go back to some of the things that Mr. Strand was bringing forth here. I was concerned as I'm listening to some of the comments that we maybe need lawmaking 101 because the legislative process is, as we know, the voice of the people, the political work of it, the tension that evolves with that. So we call it sausage making sometimes because there's such a tension that goes back and forth there. But that's where we actually represent something of the voice of the people. And we come out with bills that we set policy. I think if you're on a city council or something, you're quite aware that, or a school board, that you set at that the board level or the council level the policy, and then you expect your administration or your superintendent to carry this out and to figure out how to make it work. And that's what the executive department does. It carries out the policy, it makes it work. And in the rulemaking process of taking this broad policy and taking it down to the specific situations, there's an awful lot of public input in rulemaking. There's an awful lot that's why it's so burdensome at this time, because there's so much that goes into it. But we have to be careful about how we limit that, because we're talking about the lives of real people here. We don't want to hurt people in the process of changing rulemaking down to be basically impotent. We still need to have that policy that we have put together translated into action and executive level to carry it out. And we have the judicial department then that looks at and says, is this particular piece, as it's carried out by a business or by the executive branch or by anywhere, is this constitutional? Did it fit the actual laws that were passed? So the whole thing works in this best form of government exists, considering everything else that's out there. We have these three branches of government. Sometimes we talk in the legislature about whether we should have one house. Instead of the House and the Senate, we should just have one legislative body. Maybe we get things done more easily. That'd be fine. That's a choice of how we operate at the legislative level. But it sometimes seems to me that what we're talking about here is, let's have one branch of government. Let's just have the legislature do everything. We'll make all the decisions. After all, we're listening to the people. We'll make all the decisions for everybody. And it can't be that way. We really have to adhere to the three branches of government and how that works. If we want to adjust some of the processes in that, great. But to try to take away the power of the executive is the problem that Mr. Strand was alluding to, in my opinion, here. And I would just like his comments about that. And it does relate to, before the fact, we are setting the policy. After the fact that the rules are made, yes, then we can either set other policy, change the law. We have that option. But to say that we too will do the rulemaking just violates the whole thing, in my opinion. Is this some of what you were alluding to?
Briefly, Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with everything you said.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strand, for your testimony. Next on the list, Mr. Hottinger. If you would, sir, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent, and then please proceed briefly with your testimony. And as a time warning to members, we will be voting by noon, which is in about 34 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a much longer piece of testimony, but my voice won't last very long, so you benefited from that. My name is John Hottinger. I am a lobbyist for the Sierra Club. It's my first year doing any lobbying since I left the legislature in 2006. I had the privilege of serving in the other body, but that still counts as a privilege, for about barely 16 years. And much of that time was focused on rulemaking process. I chaired the subcommittee of the Government Operations Committee for 4 years. Mr. Quillis talked about the Legislative Commission for review of administrative rules. I was on that commission for 8 years. I was the chair for 2 years, and I appointed former Republican Representative Peggy Lepick to undertake a task force to review the administrative rules process. This isn't a new issue, folks. And back then, our goal was to improve public process, was to have a clearer way to get rules done, and to look at ways of getting them done with some more nimbleness and clarity, and to assure that there was public impact, a lot more public impact than this bill would permit, with a referral of a rule to the legislative auditor, who will appoint a 5-person committee to review that rule. We had a pretty strong tendency to think the public had a good voice and should have a good voice, Representative Pugh, in the rulemaking process. I wish that there would have been time for the author or representative to outline the provisions of this bill, because they are very complex, as opposed to the usual argument we hear that we need a rulemaking process that is clear, that is nimble, that is done in a proper time frame, and with a lot of public input. This creates a Rube Goldberg kind of process that appears designed, at least in major rules, to slow down the rulemaking process, to make it more contentious, to make it less public, and in the end, to give one house of the legislature the ability to stop a rule. And that goes to the very fundamental points, and I'm not going to repeat all the excellent testimony you've already had here. And I think the folks from the fire area maybe pointed out some of the best stuff in the sense of how this is going to make it difficult to do rules you might all agree with. In any case, I will accept everything that the previous testifier, Mr. Strand, said. But let me talk about one of those briefly, constitutional questions. In all my efforts, and I authored a lot of bills to change the rules, one of the interesting ones was I had started it before Governor Ventura became governor. But at his request, I introduced and we actually passed a provision to allow the governor to veto rules. Now, in the constitutional structure, the agency is part of the governor's executive function. But still, there were legitimate arguments raised that that was unconstitutional. It was one part of government, the governor, acting to veto a rule and excluding the legislature. Those raise the same constitutional issues as the effort here to allow the legislature, and really one house of the legislature, to put an end to rulemaking. I'm familiar with the cases that Mr. Strand talked about, and I think in these continued discussions, and I thank the author, that's the best thing I heard today, was that this is the opening of a discussion, because I think we all need to learn more about the process and how it will change. I look forward to recovering my voice, first of all, and participating in that. And one other area in the constitutional issue, Mr. Geldman would have particular familiarity with, because he was the executive director of the Board of Innovation, which had a provision that allowed this board to deal with procedural rules. There's no definition in statute or law of what a procedural rule is. Fortunately, Mr. Geltman, our provision was never tested in court, but this one will be. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the opportunity to participate further with the author and others who have an interest in learning more and helping to shape anything. I spent many years trying to shape reforms of the rulemaking process that will work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. Mr. Kirkendalco, if you would make your way down, the last testifier on our list. If you would, sir, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent, and then go ahead and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelk. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm on here today on behalf of a number of agencies, so these remarks are more than just the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. First off, I'd like to thank the author. He's had an open-door policy with us. We've had conversations on previous rulemaking bills authored already this session, and we'll continue the conversation with him, and I appreciate that openness. We all do. Overall, we just want to talk a little bit about rulemaking and then some of our concerns about specific pieces of the legislation and keep at a high level here. To start with, as many have mentioned, rulemaking is given to the agencies to work out the details of the overall policy set by the legislature. Agencies are relied upon for expertise in subject matters that require full-time and specialized knowledge. Examples that include workplace safety standards by the Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Human Services mental health facility standards, Minnesota Department of Agriculture's meat inspections, Minnesota Department of Health's drinking water standards are all examples of areas where rulemaking has been given by the legislature to the agencies to work out. It's been mentioned a number of times here that the legislature has many ways to be involved with rulemaking, so I will just skip over that portion. However, one part that has not been talked about here very much is the Office of Administrative Hearings. It provides a number of checks and balances on agencies by fulfilling the key role of judicial review during the process, making sure agencies appropriate notice the correct people, folks that are impacted by a proposed rule or may be interested, has the authority and make sure the agency has the authority and stays within the authority given by the legislature, make sure an agency establishes the need for and reasonableness of a rule. The agencies have a high threshold. There was discussion earlier about the federal threshold, which is more an arbitrary and capricious need to be met, legal need, and the state agencies in the state of Minnesota has gone to a much higher standard as a result. That's part of why Minnesota has a very complex and process-heavy rulemaking procedure, already with more oversight in rulemakings in Minnesota than other states and in the federal government. And with that background, I just want to highlight on two of our concerns. Under the bill, economic impact trumps all other concerns, such as consumer protection, human health, privacy issues, when looking at the merits of a proposed rule. It equates any proposed rule that carries more than a minimum cost as bad and puts a stop to it, unless the both bodies of the legislature are able to pass a bill to allow it. And I'll touch on that in a little bit. But some of the examples here that we have concerns about, it doesn't consider while one sector may have costs and may have there may be other economic savings in other sectors or parts of the states or consumers that may be greater. An example is regulations on financial institutions. There would be a cost to the financial institution part of the economy. However, it does not factor in the protections to the consumers and the savings there in cases of fraud or data privacy protections. It does not consider short-term costs versus long-term costs. Short-term costs of protecting the health and viability of our game and fish populations versus losing them, and their impact on economy and recreation. It doesn't factor in the benefits of rulemaking which are not economic. This is a very limited view of policy and rulemaking if we only look at one side of the ledger, if we only look at the cost. An example is drinking water and food safety protections that result in healthier families. We're looking at the economic cost and not the other benefits that are done. This is not a true cost-benefit analysis being done here, only looking at the economics. To refer back to my previous statement about the bill being put to a stop, a rule being put to a stop, again, as mentioned before, it depends on both bodies of the legislature having time to approve the rule. There are numerous times where good legislation and ideas do not advance each year because there's not enough time. I think members can relate to bills that they've had where there's been support, just not enough time, and those actions would not be implemented. The same would occur with rules. Now you're adding more good ideas to the docket to take up a limited amount of time. As mentioned also before, it's whether or not someone agrees with the issue. One body may believe a rule is not stringent enough, and as a result, put a stop to an issue. The second large theme we want to talk about is the creating duplication and redundant processes in the bill, resulting in increased cost with little or no added value. Again, looking at the full spectrum of whether a policy has looking at the cost and the overall benefits. I mentioned before the Office of Administrative Hearings has a number of roles in the rulemaking process. These are now duplicated again a second time in the bill. holding public hearings and taking testimony from interested parties is now also given to the Office of Legislative Auditor. Now we have two entities hearing and getting those comments, in addition to the agency during its process. Determining the rule is needed and reasonable, again, is being assigned to the Office of Legislative Auditor, something the Office of Administrative Hearings already does. In addition, the law prevents an agency from enforcing guidance, policy, and others that are being treated as a unpromulgated rule. Already on state law, there is a remedy through the Office of Administrative Hearings to go through this procedure. However, the new proposal encourages actions to take place just to cause a delay. The change in the bill grants an automatic stay without anyone having to show merits to the case, which is very different from how stays work in the rest of the legal realm. Also, expenses are borne by the agency even if the court confirms the agency did no wrong. It talks about only if there's a situation where there is a frivolous lawsuit. However, that still leaves a large amount of space in between where the agency did no wrong and that it's a frivolous or acting in bad faith. Finally, there's a number of duplications on what agencies work on. For instance, there's a provision discussing that the OLA will have to outline the restrictions, whether or not the proposed rule is more restrictive than federal regulations. The statement of need and reasonableness that the state agency must already fill out provides an assessment not only of each difference of it, but also the need and reasonableness of each difference between the federal government. This is reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings also, again, creating another body to do a similar act. The statement of need and reasonableness also includes a discussion of persons affected by the proposed rules and the probable cost of complying with the proposed rules, which are two parts of the main parts of a sonar that needs to be done. Again, this bill has another entity doing that, the Office of Legislative Auditor, when the Office of Administrative Hearings again reviews the sonar. In closing, agencies are focused on increasing efficiency to carry out our duties and improving the timeliness of our work and reducing the cost to do it. This bill goes in the opposite direction by creating duplicative requirements and thus unnecessarily increasing costs while adding little value. In some cases, the bill would just stop important proposed public safety and health protections and worker and financial safeguards. We believe a more effective approach is to focus on specific existing proposed rules that raise concerns. As mentioned, there were other bills that bring up specific rulemakings where there's a concern. I think if we want to work on the problem solving, let's identify those rules that may have a concern or delegate authorities for those rules and have a discussion about what needs to be done to make sure that there's the changes that are needed. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share the agency's thoughts on the legislation, and we'll continue to work with the author. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gandalf. All right, we've got several members on the list. We will be moving to a vote in 20 minutes, so if we could please be direct and concise in our comments up at this point. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the last testifier brought up the amendment, but the A2 amendment that I have, should be a time to bring that up now?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A2 amendment. And what this amendment does is it creates, puts in the bill, a regulated process protection fund. As been stated here, we're creating, when we were adding duties to the Office of Legislative Auditor, we're authorizing him to pay for and create panels, to do peer review. We're creating now the additional levels of government that we're doing here. And there's a cost to that. And most of these agencies that do regulation are fee-based and fee-funded. And so their costs are borne by the fees that they collect, and so that they're paying for what they're having to do. And those fees go on to the groups that they're regulating. So what this bill does is it creates a surcharge to protect redundant regulated industry processes. And what we're trying to do here is to say, okay, we're going to have this review. You want the review. We got to pay for it. And because we're creating this extra level of government, we need to pay for that extra level of government. These surcharges would do that. And as was stated here, we already have this process. I know, Mr. Chair, as I got them before, and I still get them from the Office of Office of Administrative Hearings, when the rules come out, they say they state whether they were reasonable, that they followed the sonar, whether they have the authority to do it. Oftentimes, when they do rules, they'll say, these three rules, things that you've said are okay, but you need to go back and relook at this and revise this. And then we get those on all the rulemaking process we go through. Every agency at the beginning of the year brings forth a note or a letter saying these are the processes, these are the rules that we're looking at reviewing. So they do that ahead of time, so we're notified of that. So we know this is going on. We're not creating another group that's going to go back and look at this after the process of making sure that they're reasonable. We're creating more of a time frame here, and again, this is adding to the cost. And that's the amendment I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing this forward. I think it's an interesting concept. However, what my desire would be as the author is that we take this and some of the other things and work on it between committees. However, I understand how the process works, and if we're going to vote on it, I accept that as well. I do also see this. I think there's some disagreement, and maybe I'm not clear on it, but I don't believe we're creating a duplicate process. And I do know what we are creating here, though, is duplicate surcharges. We are asking businesses to pay for this, something that we may already be doing, or that I'm asking, and I know, I'm asking more work for us as legislators. And my response to that is, if I'm asking more work for legislators, I certainly don't want to ask businesses to pay for that. But maybe I'm not seeing that the same way you are, and if so, I would offer that we work on this between committees. At State Gov, you're more than welcome to bring this back up, and you know, come after me and roll call me to death there, that's fine. But I would offer that we work on this because I think there's a lot of room to get there. But that's what I would ask.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, yes, that you're asking us to take work back at the legislature, but we're also putting more work on the legislative auditor. He's now on top of all the other work he's done, and he's testified before this committee and the State Government Finance Committee in the past that I have so much staff, and the more work you give me, some of the stuff that I'm supposed to be doing is going to have to slide off the table because I only have so much staff to do the job we're doing. This bill, in section or subdivision 3 on page 4.3 to 4.18, tells him that he can hire staff, he can hire or pay costs of convening a peer review advisory panel, pay experts to come in and speak. So we're adding cost to his department and not giving him an extra money. We need to pay for that somehow, and that's what this amendment seeks to do. And other thing that I'd like to say here is, and I'm going to channel Representative Pawlowski, but we should do our work in committee, and we shouldn't. The idea that we're passing legislation and say we're going to pass this on and we're going to work on it between now and the next committee, government operations, this is our purview, and we're talking about giving our authority away is what's been a lot have been talked about here. What we're doing as a committee by saying, okay, work on this between here and the next committee, we're giving our authority away of what we're supposed to be overseeing and doing our work. We're giving it away to somebody else to do, and some members of this committee are on State Government Finance is where this is going next. Some members are not. And so now we're saying that the people that aren't on State Government Finance aren't going to have a say on the upcoming amendment, on our upcoming way that gets changed. So I have problems, and I said this earlier in an earlier committee, I have problems when we pass things on. I know I worked hard when I was chairing this committee not to do that. I think there was only one instant last session that we did do that, and because we had commitment from the members, but I don't like doing that because, again, we're passing it on and assuming that someone's going to fix this next somewhere down the road, and if it doesn't get fixed, now we're passing bad legislation. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pull my amendment, but because I know the vote count here, and I know it's not going to pass one if we vote on it, but we need to look at that. We are creating processes. We are acting duplication of processes we're already doing in this bill as it is, and I know the chair, or I know that this author has said he wants to work on this. He knows this is an initial step, but I know 2 years ago when we brought this forward and worked on it, it took a long process to get both sides working on it. From what I'm hearing from the government agencies, that they haven't really been contacted. They haven't been part of the process. So we're hearing one side of the issue. And I liken it back to a commitment we've had from both parties in the past on annexation issues that also come before this committee, is that the two sides need to work it out, that we're not going to take one side or the other and ram something through that doesn't work for both sides, that we've had a commitment in the past to the townships and the cities that when you're going to work on annexation, you need to come to an agreement on this. I don't see we're at that disagreement. I see we have one side of the equation here in favor of this, and they haven't really, from what I've seen, worked with the government and the governor's staffs to try and work out the issues and try and come to an agreement. I see we're still way over on one side of the aisle. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll pull my amendment.
Representative Nelson withdraws the A2 amendment. Representative Crescia.
And just very, and I appreciate that, my admiration, Steve, Representative Nelson. You do know the process, and I will work on it. I will offer, though, I'm sorry, I forget the name. I should know him. He's been in my office many times. The guy from MCCA said, I have an open-door policy. And you know, you've been to my office many times. The other folks have not been there. They're always welcome. I have great snacks, and I always have beverages. Please stop by. We can work this out.
Okay, I have, it appears, four members left on the list with comments or closing questions. We'll be voting in 13 minutes, so if we could, members, please be respectful of the time. We'll start with Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment and a question. I believe Wisconsin passed rulemaking reform in 2013, 2012, something like that. I wonder if we know how that's working. It'd be great, you know, to know that we aren't just trying to do something completely unique to Minnesota. And the second thing is, do we have any information? I'm aware of that they're getting down to the specifics. I know we're talking high level here, but it would be helpful to see some examples of where rulemaking isn't responding quickly enough. Regarding cattails, I think there's two kinds of cattails now. I'm just wondering if rulemaking has taken into account that there are some you're as a citizen you can remove, and that there are some that you cannot. And it seems to me that, you know, the average citizen gets caught in the bind, and I think this is an example. I think there's a citizen, in fact, that is undergoing, you know, investigation, fine, whatever, because he picked on the wrong cattail. So if anyone's in the audience that knows the answer, love to hear. Otherwise, maybe we'll hear back from the appropriate agency. Thank you.
Representative Crescia, any comments? Representative Joaquin.
I'll try to make this quick, and it's more of just kind of comments and a quick question. I'm new. I most recently was a city council member, so I'm very aware of, at the local level, trying to abide by the rules and regulations the legislature creates. And I was a former staffer in the other body. And my basic, I know, I said other body. My basic
well done.
Explanation to students when I would give them tours on how this checks and balance process works is I would say, our founding fathers, in their wisdom, when they created our Constitution, it was just fathers, not mothers, made the legislature part-time. And they made them part-time because they wanted us to create the rules and laws, but then have to go back into our communities and live by those rules and laws that we created. And if they weren't working, we come back again then and fix them. So I do see the value of that checks and balances that we currently have in our system. And Representative Nelson brought up a good point that my question was on the five-person peer review advisory panel. They talk about paying for experts to come in to testify, and that's extra costs. And I was also wondering, with that new level for those that have substantial economic impact, that new layer that we're having them go through for the rulemaking, where the public input comes into play with that. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Crescia, as you are thinking about this bill, and I appreciate how open you are to thinking about this, and you're jumping into a policy area that's been thought about by many people over the years, and that's always tough to jump into and get all caught up. But question regarding when rulemaking takes place. Does it only take place during the legislative session, or does it take place when the legislature is in recess?
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson. I think that's part of the problem. We have rulemaking happening all the time that impacts us all the time, and one of the things that I'm asking for is one more layer of us to look at as legislators, not a layer of government, but as, and I've been wanting to say your name forever, so by the way, thank you, Representative Joaquin. Did I get that right? As she says, we put the rules in place, but we have to have proper ways to review those. And I may be wrong on this. I'm just saying this is one conversation to have on those reviews, and I'm offering it out for us to consider. As you said, this conversation has been happening a long time, and so I'm just trying to get us to the right place that, quite frankly, I know Representative Nelson has tried to get to and others. So I'm not doing anything new other than I'm carrying the water right now.
Well,
Representative Mr. Halverson. Chair,
and props to you for that. That's a heavy lift. And so my question about the rulemaking and when it takes place is really to raise a question about how it might impact timing for certain rules. I think there's some rules that end up with a sense of urgency around them, as the fire chiefs testified to. And so is it possible that we could be dealing with the need for special sessions in the future if we make this particular change, because we are only in session for a brief period of time?
Representative Creesha.
And just quickly, there's always possibilities. Obviously, we try to control what we fear the most. If we're worried about special sessions and all that, then we should never watch the weather, or we should never look for horrible events that may happen. So is this going to add one more thing on our backs? Absolutely. And I think that's what our folks at home have asked us to do.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Halverson,
to wrap up quickly, so thank you for that answer. And through this testimony today, and as we're thinking about this, I think the caution to think about how this is going to impact the state budget and taxpayers is an important caution. And through the testimony, I've heard a number of places where we could have a significant impact on our state budget and therefore the taxpayers, including losing federal funds, including the risk of a constitutional challenge, including the possibility of a special session, and including additional costs to the state due to another layer of oversight. And so these are not small costs and not insignificant, and so I want to be sure that we are thinking carefully about that in a global perspective. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I've got a couple questions. And a comment, or a question and a comment. I guess I'll do the comment first. I know in the past, when I was trying to work on this in the past, and that's where we were, like I said, we were on one side, this is on going the other direction. We were trying to deal with creating an additional process in there to speed up some of the simple rulemaking that we do, and that caused a lot of consternation from some people that we were trying to ace them out and ace out the public comment, which wasn't the reasoning behind that. It was, you know, there are simple rulemaking process like the DNR does, setting the deer hunting season. That's part of the rulemaking process. If they now have to come in or setting the limits on the number of deer that are taken, that's been a big issue that's been in the news about the DNR's setting of those policies. Now, if we have to take that back every year and review that, that could add significant time to the legislature process and to us, and possibly not having those things set the way they need to be set every year. So, I mean, those are concerns that I have. And we were trying to work on that last mm-hmm. year, like I said, from the other side of it, to try and create processes there where we all agree that these rules need to go in effect, but having the protections there for the ones that people have significant disagreement on, that they have to go through the long process of making sure that they meet the sonars and they meet the scientific review that they have to go through to make sure that they get done properly. But the question I have here talks to about the significant impact, and then we've talked about that. I know the other amendment that didn't get added was going to even raise that even lower. What is significant impact? I mean, if it's a banking regulation and the banks say it's going to cost a dollar per, you know, even at the $5 million for a single year, it's going to cost a dollar. They claim a dollar per customer of theirs. That could add up real quick to be a minor change, be significant impact. So are we going to then have to bring back every regulation to be looked at, to go through the peer review process, to go through all this and stretch out the time, again, take longer to make the rules, add significant cost to the rulemaking process? I guess that's the question I have.
Representative Creesha.
And if I could, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. I think the reason we're here is because clearly we think there could be improvements to the process. You worked on those. I mean, I wouldn't be in front of you with this bill if there weren't concerns. When I think of the rules, do we want to catch all of them? Absolutely not. And that's why when you say substantial impact, we need to make sure that we get that right. And all I can offer is an analogy. We're out there with a net. We're not trying to catch all the minnows, but we certainly are trying to catch the piranhas. So we have to make the holes in that net just big enough to catch the things that we want to look at, but let some of this the small minnow rules go through that they should be doing. That's, I think, all we're being asked to do. And that's going to be very hard to figure out that number. And I'll come to you. I guarantee you. You and I will be talking, and I'll be saying, "What is that number, Representative Nelson?" And we'll probably agree. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't think you were going to let me slide by with that one.
Good. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had an opportunity today where Mr. Hottinger and Mr. Gelman had a chance to kind of go down memory lane, and now it's Representative Nelson's my chance to go down memory lane on rulemaking. So it's he and I are obviously have had conversations on this in the past, and no disrespect at all, Representative Nelson, but I do recall things maybe a little bit differently than you do from the last 2 years in session. We had a number of bills that came before this committee, and I was pounding the table saying that we've got to stop expedited rulemaking, let alone rulemaking on these kinds of things, because it seemed like every agency was wanting to expedite faster than the other agency to be able to promulgate rules that would govern enforcement of these. The problem that we have is we've got Representative Cresha who's trying to take a stab at this, and we're all saying, well, Representative Cresha, thanks, but we don't like this. Let's just not deal with this issue. This legislature has got to quit closing its eyes to this issue and realize that if we don't do a rulemaking right, we abdicate more of our authority over to the legislature, over to the governor's office and to the agencies that the governor oversees. Representative Seltzer, you were spot on when you said that the legislature makes the laws, but who signs the laws? We don't. The governor does. And so if we promulgate, put in legislation the ability for rules to be promulgated, what ends up happening is if the executive branch or their agencies aren't liking the legislature's change on that as it comes to the legislative process, who has to sign the bill to change the law? The governor. So the tables are clearly stacked in the executive branch's court right now when it comes to this. We really only get one shot to make this happen. But Representative O'Driscoll, what happens if that law or that rule is so onerous that the legislature wants to overturn this? I've only been around here for 4 years, but I've watched in different committees, this committee in particular, when agencies come in and say, well, we really don't want to change that, and the committee goes, well, okay, well, we'll just take a hands off on that. We're afraid sometimes to take these things on. What's wrong with developing a process at the beginning that helps us to be able to do this and do it right? Because, yeah, we do have those legislative authorities to be able to change the law, but we don't get the ability to enact the law. The governor is the one who's going to decide. There's been some other situations earlier this year that I won't revisit on a specific basis where we were able to rein back in some of the control for the legislature. I'm hoping that we're going to be able to do that with rulemaking. And Representative Cresha, your bill may not be perfect. You've even admitted that today. I think it's worth the support of this committee to try to once again put our stake in the ground as the legislature as it relates to laws and rulemaking. Thank you.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1261 be passed and referred to civil law. We're going to change the motion to civil law. With that, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
House File 1261 is passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. With that, members, we will see you guys tomorrow. Is there any closing discussion here? Representative Nash, quickly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I could, just very quickly, I have a question for our testifier, Hannah, my daughter. Did you have fun today?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you. We are adjourned.
Very nice job.